You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report finds that the number of deaths related to drivers running red lights has hit a 10-year high in Wisconsin. We'll learn more about what's happening and how motorists, pedestrians, and bicyclists can stay safe on the roads. Right now, it's time for a weekly check-in on news stories from around the state. First, the Canadian energy firm Enbridge is seeking permission to conduct land surveys as it considers rerouting its Line 5 oil pipeline in northern Wisconsin. Yesterday, an Enbridge representative attended a meeting of the Mellon City Council about half an hour south of Ashland to talk about the company's plans. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She was at that meeting. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Why is Enbridge considering a reroute of this Line 5 pipeline?
Yeah, so Enbridge is moving forward with exploring a reroute of its line because the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa filed a federal lawsuit against them in July, requesting the company shut down the flow of oil there and remove that segment of pipeline from their reservation because of fears that it might rupture and that a segment of that pipe is becoming exposed.
So what is Enbridge looking to do at this point? This would be early stages, right?
Right. Yeah. They're just looking and exploring possible routes for another location for the pipeline. So right now they are conducting surveys along a 40-mile stretch in Ashland and Iron counties to replace an existing 20-mile segment of Line 5. And that's according to a letter that they sent out to property owners.
That takes us to this meeting. Now, what kind of things did area residents have to say to an Enbridge representative?
Well, there was a lot of concern about the company's environmental track record. They pointed to the 2010 Kalamazoo River spill in Michigan, where more than 1 million gallons of oil was released, and that cost the company more than $1.2 billion to clean up. They're afraid of something like that possibly happening in their neck of the woods. They also had concerns about their land being taken through eminent domain. They're concerned about their water resources. They don't like the way that the process is unfolding with these surveys. Some residents felt like they have been harassed by these agents, who some have said they feel are not taking no for an answer. So the concerns were kind of vast.
What has Enbridge brought up in response either at that meeting or previously?
Enbridge has said that they're not trying to intimidate anyone. They don't want to harass anyone. All they're looking for is approvals of the surveys, which would not mean that they would have any rights to those lands. If they decide to move forward with a project in the future, then they would start talking about announcing plans and beginning a permitting process with local, state, and federal officials, and then looking for agreements with landowners. They say that they've learned a lot since the 2010 Kalamazoo River spill and that they've made a lot of changes to improve safety and integrity on their lines.
And getting back to the Bad River Band, who want the pipelines off of their direct land, you've written that they're not necessarily excited even about the proposed alternate routes.
No, because as they see it, any relocation of that pipeline, it would still be in the headwaters of the Bad River watershed. So anything that happens upstream of them could potentially have an impact on the reservation downstream. So they're not satisfied with seeing any reroute.
This is, again, in early stages. Is there any kind of timeline that you're watching for something to happen next, Danny?
No, right now the company has said they don't have a specific timeline. They're conducting the surveys right now. They'd like to do it while there is no snow on the ground so they can get an idea of some of the environmental resources that are located in this area, but no timeline as of yet for any solid plans to move forward with a reroute.
Let's touch on something else you've written about, Danny. Automated breathalyzer kiosks that some counties are starting to use for court-ordered alcohol screenings. What's going on there?
Well, this is supposed to free up people's staff time at the jails or with criminal justice coordinators because they're finding that whenever they need to have people come in with court-mandated alcohol screening, then there needs to be a staff person present for those breathalyzer tests. So these kiosks would allow them to take those tests without the presence of a supervisor, freeing up some to do other tasks. For example, in one of the counties that I talked to, Lafayette County, their jailers are also dispatchers. So they're already doing a couple of jobs and then having to add on, you know, monitoring people doing alcohol screening. It just makes things even more busy, and it can hold up people who are waiting for these tests if they have to wait for someone to be available to take them. So the idea is that this creates more convenience for both staff and for the people taking the tests.
Danny, I hadn't heard of these things until I read your reporting on this. How widely used are these kiosks in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I didn't really know anything about it either until I had seen something about this in an agenda. It's being used across at least 8 counties right now, including Racine, Door, St. Croix, and Sawyer counties. The company that has created these kiosks, Precision Kiosk Technologies, is hoping that they can expand it to 19 counties by the end of the year. And they said that they've conducted more than 84,000 tests already in the 2 years that this has been happening in Wisconsin, and that they have a 99.5% compliance rate.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter in Superior. She joined us to talk about new breathalyzer kiosks different counties are trying out. Also, she told us about a request by Enbridge Energy to survey properties as it considers rerouting a pipeline south of Ashland. Now, residents of Coon Valley in western Wisconsin's Vernon County have seen a lot of flooding in the last few years. Heavy rain last summer in particular caused damage that's still affecting the community. Hope Kerwin is a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. She recently talked with city officials and residents about how they're preparing for floods in the future. Hope, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you remind us about the storms that hit the Coon Valley area last year August, and the damage they caused?
Yeah, so these were storms that happened at the very end of August in 2018, and it dropped about up to 10 inches of rain in across this region in only a few hours. So that caused a lot of water rushing to Coon Creek, which is the creek that flooded Coon Valley, and really caused a lot of damage in a park that is right downtown called Veterans Memorial Park, and a number of homes and businesses.
And some of that damage is still there, right? Still not repaired.
Yeah, so there were a handful of homes and at least one business that village officials say have been damaged beyond repair, that people aren't using those structures anymore. Part of the problem is this village also saw flooding this July when we saw another severe storm roll through this area. And so it's just kind of a repeat incident that has really prevented residents from being able to make the necessary repairs.
You write that that flood back in 2008 basically overwhelmed the dams and other flood control infrastructure there. What is the state of that now?
Yeah, so there 6 dams were damaged in the 2018 flood. 3 of those dams were just needed some repairs, and Monroe County, which is where the dams are located, they went ahead and made those repairs. But 3 of the dams were actually breached, fully, damaged beyond repair, basically. And so the county has chosen not to move forward with replacing those structures because they are applying for funding through NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is a federal program, to do a new watershed study for Coon Creek. The official that I talked to at Monroe County, Bob McKeel, he says that they basically can't build a structure that can withstand the floodwaters that they continue to see on Coon Creek. And so they know that they need to find new solutions to deal with the increased flooding that we continue to see in this area.
And it would be expensive to do that, to build dams that could withstand the kind of flooding they're seeing now. And you write, this is something that would be way too much for the local government to afford. Is that right?
Yeah, he said, these are basically millions of dollars of projects. And so they can't afford to keep replacing these structures and have them be, you know, damaged by the next flood. So that's why they're seeking this federal funding to be able to do a watershed study to be smarter with and more efficient with that money.
You spent time talking to people there about the prospect of future flooding. What kind of things did people have to say?
you know, it's always a sad thing to see people's homes, businesses be impacted. And, you know, there's definitely concern about the next time we see a severe storm roll through that there's just going to experience the same thing over again. But there's definitely a resiliency within that village and people confident that they're going to, you know, remain there, that they're going to find a way to deal with this flooding. And there's really just an urgency, a sense of urgency, as it was described to me, to be proactive on this issue. They don't want to keep experiencing this flooding, but they see the writing on the wall that the next time we see a severe storm, it's likely to happen.
This big flood was in August of 2018. Last month, there was a fundraising event to try to raise money for flood preparedness. What was going on?
Yeah, so Coon Valley historically has had a canoe race on Coon Creek, but it's been about 20 years since they held that event. And so the local business association and several other local organizations got together to bring back the canoe race on Coon Creek as a way to raise money for flood mitigation. When I last talked with officials there, they were still working out the numbers to see how much they raised or if they broke even with the event. But they said they had over 100 teams participate, and from not only from this southwestern region, but, you know, as far away as Illinois, Minneapolis, coming to just, you know, participate in this event to help raise money. They're still deciding what they're going to be doing as far as investing in local flood mitigation, exploring different ideas. You know, I talked to the village president. He said he's looked into things like temporary levees to see if they could put up if they know a storm is coming or if they know the water is high. I also heard talks of rain barrels or different ways, you know, community members can focus on water retention, keeping water from flowing all into the creek at the same time.
Hope, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hope Kerwin is a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. She talked with us about how residents in Coon Valley are handling the likelihood of more damaging floods in the future. She wrapped up our weekly roundup of state news. Drivers running red lights can cause significant and deadly collisions on roadways. A new report from AAA Wisconsin finds that the number of deaths related to drivers running red lights has hit a 10-year high in the state. Our next guest joins us to talk about the report and how drivers, pedestrians, and bicyclists can stay safe as they're traveling. Nick Jarmus is Director of Public Affairs for AAA Wisconsin. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, a new report from AAA Wisconsin looks at the latest numbers we have. I think it was from 2017. What do we see going on here in the state over time when it comes to these red light collisions?
Well, what we're seeing is simply a pretty dramatic increase in the number of fatal crashes caused by red light runners. And this is not necessarily just a Wisconsin problem. Our study looked at all state data from across the country and found that this is a problem nationally as well. But Wisconsin does have one of the worst increases and largest increases in the number of these fatalities.
When we look nationwide, how big a problem, how many incidents do we see that involve fatal collisions from running red lights?
Well, nationwide in 2017, which is the most recent year that we have data available for, there were about 939 of these fatalities, and that's up from 799 back in 2008. And that increase over the last 10 years is a pattern that was replicated in pretty much all 50 states.
Now, that's, I think, a fairly small part of overall road fatalities, but the frustrating thing is this seems like one of these really easy ones to prevent. It's pretty easy to not run a red light.
It is. And, you know, what's really discouraging is that when we do surveys every year to ask folks about which driving behaviors do they consider, you know, dangerous or unacceptable, red light running, you know, is always at the top of the list. About 90% of people say that it is dangerous. It is unacceptable to do it. And yet one out of every three in those surveys say that they have done it themselves in the last 30 days. So it's, you know, one of many examples of a do as I say, not as I do mentality when it comes to driving in America.
What are some of the factors that lead us to run that red light?
Well, we think, you know, two of the possible factors in this increase are just an overall increase in distraction and inattention behind the wheel, where people are not seeing the red light or the light change. They're not paying attention to the stale greens as they approach an intersection, and that's leading them to, end up either unintentionally going through the red light or going through because they didn't realize they should be stopping until it was too late, and then they end up just going through anyway. The other factor that we think plays a role is just the overall sense of impatience on the road, and we've seen an increase in a number of different what we call aggressive driving behaviors, things like excessive speeding, running red lights would be one of them. Tailgating is another example of that, where people are driving very aggressively. And this is a problem that no one seems to know how to really get their hands around, because it's more of a cultural problem that we can't necessarily enforce our way out of. And so we need, some strategies that can really get at these root causes that are making people very impatient behind the wheel.
Talking to Nick Jarmus, Director of Public Affairs for AAA Wisconsin, about a new report looking at people running red lights and the fatalities that result from them. Wisconsin sees a 10-year high in the most recent numbers. It's a problem, he says, nationwide. Nick, your report offers us some red light hygiene, if you will. And one of the suggestions you make for drivers involves what you just referred to, the stale green lights. This is a phrase I hadn't heard before. What do we mean by the stale green light?
Well, we know, signalized intersections work on timers. And so there's going to be a cycle that the light will be green for a certain amount of time and then change to yellow and then change to red. So as you're approaching an intersection, if you're paying enough attention, you can tell how long the light has been green. And if light has been green for, 30 seconds to up to a minute, depending on how that intersection is timed out, you can almost anticipate that by the time you approach the intersection, it may or would likely be changing to yellow or to red, and kind of even begin braking before the light changes, or begin slowing down before the light changes in anticipation of that change coming up. But if you're distracted and you're not paying attention to the signals in the distance, then you're going to approach that intersection at full speed, and the light is going to be, change from green to yellow, and you're going to end up making the determination that it would be, too difficult to try to brake for it now. I'm just going to go through, and depending on how long the yellow is timed for or where you're at in the intersection when you made that decision, it may actually change to red while you're going through or even right before you go through.
And Nick, I think we've all been in that position of that yellow light, and it's a coin toss. Can we make it? Can we not? The tendency is to accelerate to make sure we make it. Are you hoping we tip the balance, that weight in the other direction?
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest things is our misinterpretation of what the yellow light should be telling us to do. And one, thing to consider for folks to consider in that calculation is that, yes, if you slam on your brakes, you run the risk of maybe the person behind you rear-ending you, and then you're causing a collision anyway. But a rear-end collision like that is far less likely to cause serious injuries or fatalities than an angle collision or a perpendicular collision, what we commonly call a T-bone collision, if you were to proceed through the red and end up striking cross traffic that's coming in on their green. So it actually would be safer, in a sense, to slam on the brakes and risk someone might rear-end you than to proceed through and risk that more dangerous type of crash.
Then on the side of defensive driving, your recommendations, both for drivers actually and pedestrians, is to maybe assume that other people might be getting ready to run that light that's just changed.
That's right. And, another way to think of that is to not assume that the signal itself, can predict that it's safe to go. So, defensively looking up and saying, just because my light has changed to green doesn't inherently mean it's safe for me to go without checking. And so double check for yourself anyway before you proceed through, just in case someone is on the other side of that equation and is making the calculation to just blow through that yellow or stale green into red and risk striking them or being struck by them.
I want to pull out from the red light specific conversation, Nick, what we were talking about earlier with this rise in aggressive, impatient driving. And yeah, that seems like a head scratcher to try to solve it. But can you have a message for drivers to maybe change their state of mind a little bit?
Well, I think one of the most important things is to change people's perception of the acceptability of risk on the road. And you know, there's sometimes a very direct or an indirect way that we think of crashes and fatalities on the road is just sort of the cost of doing business, so to speak. You know, they're inevitable. They're going to happen. You know, if there's this many people on the road, it's just you're going to have so many crashes or fatalities. And that's just simply not true. I mean, crashes don't simply happen. Even with an increase in the number of people on the road, an increase in the number of miles those people are driving, that doesn't inherently mean there's going to be more crashes, because crashes, again, they don't just happen. They are caused by people making mistakes behind the wheel or making bad decisions behind the wheel. And re-embracing the concept of vision zero or zero fatalities being the goal, it was recently announced that the state of Wisconsin is re-embracing that and is going to be relaunching that campaign here, you know, changing that paradigm to where, you know, we can and should be looking towards zero fatalities on the road being the ultimate goal. And so we don't begin to casually accept, you know, a certain number of fatalities just because that's the cost of doing this.
And very briefly, Nick, I don't think I've heard you say the word accident yet. Is that a word you avoid in this context?
It is, and over the last 15 years, I've gotten very careful about that because, you know, crashes, it's a colloquialism. And, you know, I realize most people don't think much about it when they say it, but certainly, you know, accidents are things that, you know, happen that cannot be avoided or aren't anyone's fault. And the bottom line is that every crash, you know, as difficult as it may be to say this, every crash is someone's fault. Someone has to have made a mistake. It may have been completely unintentional. It may be a matter of negligence rather than, you know, act of hostility.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Nick Jarmus from AAA Wisconsin. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. 2011 United Nations report says about a third of all the food produced on Earth ultimately goes to waste each year. That's roughly 1.3 billion tons. Assuming we maintain that pace, the amount of annual waste is expected to rise to 2.1 billion tons by 2030. Besides being ethical and economic problems, the UN pointed out that wasted food emits a significant amount of greenhouse gas. So the UN adopted a goal to reduce global food waste by 50% by 2030, but they didn't really come up with a plan on how to do it. Now the organization World Resources Institute did, and they rolled it out last week. Craig Hansen is the Vice President of Food, Forests, Water, and the Ocean at World Resources Institute. Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, when people think of food waste, we might think of the stuff that goes bad at home in our refrigerator. That's just one point of food waste. What do we know about where in the chain food gets wasted?
Well, food gets wasted everywhere from the chain, from the farm all the way to the fork. So it's the farmer as he or she is harvesting the grains and the equipment doesn't pick up all the grains and the grains stay in the field, to the storage, right? When in Africa you've harvested your food and it goes in storage, but then because it's not temperature controlled, it rots or pests get to it. All the way to transportation, the food that actually falls off the truck or spoils in transportation, to the retailer. Right, the food that doesn't get sold at the retail store and gets thrown out, and then finally at the home or the restaurant.
Before we get into solutions, I want to look at some of the consequences here. First of all, when it comes to our food supply, how significant is this loss of food to the effort to feed humans around the world?
It's a pretty big issue, right? As you opened up, 1/3 of all food that's intended for human consumption is lost or wasted between the farm and fork. 1/3. That's amazing, especially in a world where 1 in 9 people are actually undernourished today across the planet. So that dichotomy is a travesty.
And then environmental consequences. This UN report mentioned, and I think that's not something I hadn't really thought about before. What are the environmental impacts of wasted food?
Pretty broad. Food loss and waste accounts for about a quarter of all the fresh water that's used in the agricultural system around the planet. Well, a quarter of all the fresh water, right, is used to grow food that no one ends up eating. It also emits 8% of greenhouse gas emissions. And this is, you know, this is the food that gets thrown out, ends up in decaying in a landfill, to all the emissions from fertilizer use used to grow food that no one eats, to the land that's being cleared to grow food that isn't eaten as well. So 8%. In fact, if food loss and waste were its own country, it'd be the third biggest greenhouse gas emitter after China and the United States.
And do we really have a solid handle on the problem? I've seen people suggest that, you know, we don't even really know how to measure this. People are using different standards to measure what food counts as wasted, if it's fed to animals, that sort of thing. Do we have a global standard to even understand the problem?
Yes, it's a while ago, there was a lot of confusion around what counts as food loss and waste and how do you actually quantify it. A standard has emerged. WRI was involved with this along with UN agencies and others to create the Food Loss Waste Protocol, kind of a global standard for what gets measured and how you measure it. So we're now a number of companies and countries are starting to quantify their food loss waste in accordance with that standard. So we're starting to get better data about how much and where is being lost and wasted.
We're talking about wasted food with Craig Hansen from the World Resources Institute. That organization has a plan now, a global action agenda aimed at cutting food waste by half by the year 2030. Let's get into that plan now, Craig. Before we get into details, give us the quick elevator pitch of what this plan aims to do.
Well, the plan basically aims to help companies, governments and individuals cut in half the amount of food that's lost or wasted between the farm and the fork by the year 2030. There's three core elements, right? The first is we call it Target Measure Act. Set a target to cut your food loss and waste in half, measure it, because what gets measured gets managed, and then take action. The second step is we've created a to-do list for anyone from farmers all the way to consumers, five things that you can do to get going to actually reducing your food loss and waste. And finally, to help take things to scale, we've developed 10 scaling interventions, 10 big things that we think that can really help accelerate the reduction of food loss and waste.
At the national level, again, you call on countries to come up with their own strategies. I understand some countries already have policies and laws in place. What kind of things are already happening around the world?
Yeah, so a number of countries have started to put in place certain policies, for instance, to help make it easier to donate food that ends up being unsold. So it used to be the case that, say, a retail store or a restaurant would be afraid to actually give unsold food to, say, a charity for fear of being sued, right, if someone got sick by it. So what's rolled out in a number of countries, including here in the United States, in many states, is a Good Samaritan laws that basically say, look, you know, no one's going to sue you if something, you know, if someone gets sick by some food that you've donated. And that's actually helped ease and increase the amount of food that gets donated to food charities in these countries that have passed those laws. At the same time, in some European countries have actually required retail stores that are bigger than a certain size to give food to charities, that they can't just throw it all out. So there's a number of policies starting to pop up.
But it might not be a one-size-fits-all approach, it sounds like. A different country, a different level of development, say, might have different needs.
Exactly. You know what? So one thing the data does tell us around the planet is that in developed regions like North America, Europe, the vast majority of food loss and waste occurs at the consumption stage, at the household, at the restaurant, you name it, right? In fact, in the United States, something like 60% roughly of all food loss waste occurs at the consumption stage. And that means to really tackle that, you need policies or approaches or behavior changes that get to how the consumer handles his or her food. But in the developing world, places like in Africa, more than half of the food loss waste occurs really close to the farm during harvesting or during storage. And so there, the interventions are needed there by, you know, technologies and incentives for better storage or for better harvesting equipment so that less food is lost from the farm all the way to the market.
I saw it referenced to technologies like maybe solar-powered coolers to help keep food food last longer, maybe getting from the farm to the consumer in those cases.
Exactly. So this is really true in Africa. There's, you know, one of the issues in Africa, you have a lot of smallholder farmers, you know, people that have less than an acre of land, and a lot of them, when they harvest, They don't have storage technologies, and you're not connected to the grid. And so storage becomes really difficult. So some companies have come together to think through, how do we actually offer low cost, low carbon storage? And so what they've done is they've basically taken big crates that basically have solar panels attached to them, and you actually can store your food, your fruits and vegetables, keep it cold, get it ready, get it to the market, or get it ready when the prices go up. And it's all solar powered, and therefore they don't have to be connected to the grid. And to help finance it, they've done what they call like a pay-to-chill model. And so the village will basically pay a small fee, right, over time. And over a course of 3 years, they actually end up owning the equipment. So it's a nice combination of technology and financing to tackle a problem.
So in that case, it sounds like this approach to food waste could also be an economic development strategy.
Exactly. In many parts of the developing world, you know, when you lose a lot of food, that is actually lost revenue as well as lost food for farmers. And so one way to take a first step towards moving up the economic development ladder is to make sure that if I'm a farmer, the food I grow makes it into my family's stomach or makes it to the market or both.
That's the national level. Let's go all the way to the other end of things and talk. Most of our listeners here are in the United States. What kind of things can food consumers do to start to cut back on waste, maybe in their own households?
Yeah, I get this question a lot, everyone consumes food and everyone wastes food, right? And so the first question is, what can I do? Well, a couple simple tips that we have in our to-do list, right, for households is, first of all, it sounds really obvious and basic, but oftentimes it doesn't happen. It's buy what you expect to eat, right? And so little tips for doing that, check the refrigerator before you go out shopping, right? And also create a shopping list, right? And behavioral studies show that actually people who make shopping lists actually end up over time wasting less food because they buy actually what they need, right? Secondly, is know the difference between a used by, a best before, and a sell by date. So we've all seen these words on the top of your milk carton, and sometimes it'll say sell by. And until I got into this, I used to think, if a sell by was September 6th, 2019, if it was September 7th, I'd throw it out, thinking it's unsafe to drink. But all sell by actually means is this is the optimal time for actually the retailer to actually sell. It's a message to the people that's managing the shelves on the store. The food is actually still good to eat or drink, right? But a lot of people don't know that. And so a lot of companies now, and it's happening here in the United States, are actually taking the sell by dates and converting it to barcodes so you and I don't get confused by the sell-by date. What's left over is either a use-by date or a best before. Now, use-by, that's the one to pay attention to. Use-by means after that date, it might turn sour. You probably shouldn't eat it for health reasons. But the best before date is what it means. It's best before, but it's still good after. So best before is usually on things like cookies and pasta and stuff like that. Yeah, after September 6th, it may not be the peak freshness. It's still healthy to eat. It's still good. So understanding what the date labels mean is really important for households to reduce their waste.
We're talking about how to reduce food waste. There's a lot of it around the globe, over a billion tons a year by many estimates. Craig Hansen is with us from the World Resources Institute. They have a new plan aimed at cutting food waste by half over the next 10-ish years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about food waste? Is there something you've done in your own household that works for you to help you waste less food? Do you do something in the food chain as part of your job? A farmer, a food processor, grocery store, restaurant, you name it. What do you do when it comes to food waste where you work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on the global food waste problem with Craig Hansen. He's Vice President of Food, Forests, Water, and the Ocean at the World Resources Institute. The United Nations says a third of all food produced for humans on Earth, about 1.3 billion tons, is wasted each year. Our guest organization has a plan aimed at cutting that by about half. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is food waste a problem at your home? Have you done something to try to rein it in? Do you have a question about food waste, where it comes from, what people are doing about it? And if you work in the food industry somewhere along the chain, what do you see happening? Have you or your business made efforts to cut food waste. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Anita joins us now in Muskego. Anita, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Anita?
Well, I just had an observation that when we go out to restaurants, the portions are just enormous for the most part. And they don't offer like a small size or a medium size, a large size. And it's always, you know, one size fits all. And many times people could eat about half of what they're offered. And I think a lot of times that food just gets thrown away.
Anita, thanks a lot for the call. Food waste at restaurants, Craig. Is that part of the problem?
It is. It is. And it's one of the things we've identified in a number of countries, U.S. just being one of them. Yeah, the size of the portions are too big. And interestingly, I grew up in from Nebraska, and I grew up, and when we go out, they actually had doggy bags. Interestingly, in Europe, that's a foreign concept, and it's just now starting to start to roll out. Places like Denmark, et cetera, are now starting to allow doggy bags, which I always thought was a pretty clever idea. So portion sizes, ideally, to shrink would be one thing to tackle at a restaurant. Offering doggy bags is another strategy for tackling that.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Craig, how do we stack up in the United States per person? How wasteful are we when it comes to food?
We're pretty wasteful. The United States is the most wasteful in terms of a per person, per capita amount of food loss and waste on the planet. It's very high. The interestingly, countries that have lower amounts per person typically are the less developed ones, like places like in Africa, where the more food actually ends up being consumed by the person. But yeah, we're quite inefficient in the United States as consumers of food.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts or questions about food waste. Can we change our social norms on food waste in the United States, Craig? Or is this a cultural mindset change that you're looking to make?
There is. So in our three-part global agenda, on the final element, which is, you know, scaling interventions, one of them really is about shifting social norms. You know, it used to be the case, you know, when you looked at literature and even talking with grandparents is, you know, back in the day, you ate everything that was on your plate, right? And food was precious, and there was a war going on, or, you know, my mother would tell me there's people starving in Africa. Eat everything on your plate, and we did, right? Now it's kind of shifted, right? It's no one, you know, you don't feel bad, you know, scraping off that food off your plate and put it in the garbage can. What we need is a social norm shift where you do feel bad by scraping that food off of your plate. And therefore, it starts to change your behavior. Just like in the 1960s, people would throw plastic cups and tin cans outside their car window driving on the road, and you had a big litter problem on the side of the roads. Well, in the 70s, there was a big movement, right, to stop that, right? And nowadays, my generation, my daughter's generation, you don't even think of throwing litter out in the road, right? So a cultural, social norm shift occurred there with litter that I would argue we need to have also with food waste.
You know, we've talked about national efforts, individual consumer efforts. We've touched on restaurants. How about food processing companies? Where can they contribute to this cutback in food waste?
So food processors, one thing that global data seems to indicate is that the processing stage of the food value chain is probably the most efficient. And part of that is because, you know, if I'm a food processor, I always have some additional use for whatever I shave off. I'm making cheese or whatever, or making grains, making cereals. Whatever gets cut off isn't used, is usually used in some other product, right? So processing tends to be quite efficient. That said, in countries that don't have yet quite achieved that efficiency, it is finding that alternative use for what doesn't end up in a food product. It's also about creating new food products. We've seen a number of examples where items that before would have been thrown out and wasted actually get turned into, converted into a new food. I mean, the fruit smoothie, right, that's, you know, going gangbusters in the United States, is actually a use of food that oftentimes otherwise might have gone to waste.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mike is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Mike?
Yeah, I wanted to talk some more about the gases, you know, that all this wasted food is causing. I'm a big fan of, well, I'm the guy in the circle that eats everybody else's pizza crust.
Me too, man.
So, yeah. Why throw that away? That's the best car. Anyway, the gases that you were talking about, how can you get into those a little bit?
Oh, yeah, the contribution, Craig, of food waste to greenhouse gas emissions. Where is that coming from?
Yeah, so that 8% figure I mentioned comes from a couple areas. So at the end of the cycle, so the food you and I throw out in our garbage ends up getting dumped in a landfill. As it decays, it turns into methane. And methane, as we know, is one of the most powerful and potent forms of greenhouse gas emissions, right? So that's one piece. But then you go to, you know, near the farm, right? It takes fertilizer to grow a lot of plants, and the application of fertilizer, some of it get as the fertilizer that's not used by the plant, it decays into the atmosphere as nitrous oxide, which itself is a greenhouse gas. So those fertilizers used to grow food that doesn't end up being eaten, that's a contribution to climate, to greenhouse gas emissions. And then before that, you know, there, every year more and more land, in, especially in the tropics, is being converted from natural grassland or forest to become farmland. Some of that is basically used to grow food that ends up not being eaten. So you have those land use change emissions, those deforestation emissions that are created that for food that ends up not being eaten by us.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Craig Hansen from the World Resources Institute, looking at efforts to cut food waste. Back to your calls. Bob is with us in Roberts. Bob, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Bob?
So I used to work at a truck stop. I won't name the name, but what they used to do to cut down on the food waste through the business is once the food technically expired and they couldn't sell it anymore, they had a freezer in the back where they would put all the leftover food and donate it to a local church for homeless people or less fortunate. Some of that just needed a meal.
All right, Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And Craig, they're probably not alone in that. Are you seeing food-related businesses making sure they donate the still edible food that they need to get rid of?
Yes, we're seeing actually that's a great strategy that the caller had there. And so I'm glad to hear that that's what they did. We're seeing actually an increase in the amount of food that is, you know, it's at the expiry date ends up being, you know, stored or stored as, you know, frozen, so it doesn't expire, or immediately get delivered to a charity. And one thing that's happened in the past past 3 to 5 years is the emergence of apps to help speed the connection of I'm a retail store, I'm a truck stop, I've got some extra food. Then there's a charity, you know, within the 20-mile radius. You know, in the past, it'd sit there. You didn't know who to call, who to go to. And now they have these, in a lot of places, the U.S. as well, and a lot of European countries have these apps now. And it's already set up, right? The app will say, I'm a retail store, I got you know, 5 bunches of bananas, you know, 15 bags of apples and some, and you know, 15 bread rolls from the bakery. It's going to expire at 6 o'clock. And at 6:01... right? The charity's at your door because they got this signal from the app, and basically the charity basically gets the food right away. And so it maximizes the amount that actually it gets to those in need. It's a fantastic type of blending of an issue that solves another problem by leveraging technology.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Craig Hansen, Vice President of Food, Forests, Water, and the Ocean at the group World Resources Institute. We talked with him about the global food waste problem. There's a lot of it in the United States and elsewhere around the world, and his organization's 10-point plan aimed at cutting food waste in half around the world by the year 2030. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, if you feel like you have trouble dealing with your emotions, you're not alone. The author of the new book, Permission to Feel, says we can unlock the power of our emotions to have happier lives and to raise happier, healthier children. Money is driving a lot of kids out of youth sports, and our guest says that means many kids get less exercise and less opportunity. And we'll meet the Trumpeter Swan and learn about a 30-year effort to help them recover here in Wisconsin. Plus, find out about the best places to check out leaves in Wisconsin throughout this fall. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.